I had just started to say something about watching the words that we use. Over the years, I have worked very hard at trying to eliminate all the sort of standard jargon, preachers' in words, and a phraseology and a style of speaking that sort of develops in Christian preachers and expositors. I've always tried to find an ordinary word so that if any person walks in off the street, even if they're ignorant of the Bible, they'd at least understand what I'm talking about. I think we ought to work hard at that. If we can't explain a thing in simple language that the uninitiated can understand, then there's a reasonable chance we don't understand the thing clearly ourselves. So I work on two things. Trying to put a thing in writing, A, so that I can preserve the fruit of my study, but B, so that I can clarify my thoughts and I can actually express something that I think I know. So that's a help. But putting it in writing to clarify and so on. And also to find the easy words. That's the other thing I concentrate on. Trying to express whatever it is in a way that anybody can understand. Now, there are going to be some difficulties. You obviously have to explain what you mean by saved, salvation, faith, repentance, and all sorts of other biblical words. Okay, you can't get away from that. But let's make sure we explain what we mean by them. There are other words, however, that we need not use so much, because even though they're in one of the traditional translations of the Bible, you may find there's something different in a more recent translation. Like I mentioned the word flesh. Now, we could give a talk on the works of the flesh and the problems of the flesh, but it's probably a good idea to get into the habit of talking about the sinful human nature. It would be advisable that we identify the two terms when we're speaking, so that everybody knows that flesh equals sinful human nature. But having made that identification, let's just then move along and drop the more unfamiliar, the sort of the more theological or jargonish type term, and use the more all-embracing one. That's what I would suggest. Now, you're not going to be able to get out of using salvation, even justification. God puts people right with himself. Well, again, we can use that, but I think we have to introduce them at least to the term justification. How much we use it will depend on other factors in our sermon. But never assume that they know what these words mean. In fact, you can't even assume that the speakers themselves sometimes know what they mean. So let's make sure that we do know what we're talking about. And we've got to find a balance between using the technical word and then using the equivalent in ordinary words. And I, again, discipline myself as a rule to make sure there's a balance so that we're constantly making the identification. And by the time you're finished, everybody knows what you're on about, whether they're familiar previously with the jargon or not. There is other jargon, however, that we ought to throw out completely, and that's some of the standard jargon that grows up with preachers. And it's not just brethren. I move in a reasonably wide circle and I meet people from all sorts of backgrounds, and I find that many of the things that we complain about are equally complained about by people in other denominations. And the jargon that I hear that sometimes grates, you know, in some local assembly, you hear the same thing when you go to some other church or interdenominational convention. So we've got to think all the time. Christians are weird people. Christians have got this language that they speak that the rest of the community doesn't use at all. Return thanks. Let us return thanks. I don't know anybody who returns thanks in our society other than Christians. Worse still, render thanks. That's a good one. And yet you hear it all the time. Now people walk in off the street and immediately they say, "Ooh, you know, what's going on here?" Those sorts of expressions really serve to alienate the uninitiated. Okay, I'm not talking too much about speaking to non-Christians here today, but get into the habit now so that even no matter who's there, we speak in the same language. Honestly, when I speak to non-Christians, I don't speak much differently from what I'm speaking here. We use pretty well the same language, and it ought to be that way in our room instead.
What about journeying mercies?
Journeying mercies. I go to Nigeria, and one of the nationals, they use English in Nigeria, and they use other things as well, but he thanks God for journeying mercies. Well, I couldn't resist it, of course, could I? So I said to him afterwards, I said, "Where did you get that expression, journeying mercies?" Well, you can have a few guesses if you like as to where you might have got it. But the thing is, it's become part of the jargon there. And I said, now you've taken something. I said, even people in native English-speaking countries don't use journeying mercies other than people that go to certain types of churches. But that journeying mercies, everybody uses it, you know, across the Christian spectrum here. It's not just brothers that use that one. What were you going to say?
Lay the five on a bed of sticks. Yeah.
Well, you've had more experience in cleaning up the mess than some of the others. But, okay, you see what I mean? Now, we laugh at that, but we are all guilty at different times of expressions. Now, they may not be as bad as the bed of sickness thing or the journeying mercies, or just the word just, or really, or truly, or do. Count the number of times sometimes that you get those in your prayer. If you're uncharitable, you can count somebody else's prayer. But if you're more Christian, count your own prayer. I discipline myself. Every now and again, I'll be sitting in a group in our prayer group, and I'll say, Justin, Lord, we just pray that you will just bless this person. And I'm thinking, 75, 76, 77. So then I check myself next time I pray, and believe it or not, you find a couple of justs have snuck in. Maybe a really do earnestly do pray, not just ordinary pray, but do pray, or really, really do pray, and just really do pray. And so all of these things. All right. We shouldn't be uncharitable in picking people to bits, but I think we ought to be very, very ruthless with ourselves in exercising that sort of discipline to eliminate those expressions from our prayers, preaching and general conversation. Somebody asked a question about concentration span. Yes, so while I think of a concentration span, I would imagine, now this is just a total poke in the dark, I would have imagined that most people here had probably more difficulty concentrating through this previous session than they did concentrating the very first session this morning. One of the reasons is that in this last session you did nothing but sit there while I talked the whole time. Whereas in the first session, all the time we were looking backwards and forwards at the Bible and we were turning pages over. Now that's what we should be doing when we're expounding the scriptures. The audience is involved. This whole idea of standing up and reading a text and then speaking for half an hour while they all sit and listen, we've got to get rid of that. By using this expository method that I'm talking about, the audience is going to be involved every couple of minutes. And you say, now if you look at verse 35, they're very obedient. People are very submissive. You say, look at verse 35 and all their heads go down like that. Unless you're in an Anglican church. I tell you, I've preached in Anglican churches and I've got some good friends in the Anglicans and all the rest of it. So I'm not trying to, you know, sink the sword into them or anything like that. But they are not trained as we are in looking at the Bible and following it. Many of them walk to church with their hands in their pockets and they lift up a Bible out of the slot and put it back. They read the text. I was once in India, I preached in an Anglican church there, and I had to fill in the text. The preacher fills in the text, and so the verger, or the whatever they call him, sidekick or something, he's there and he says, will you fill in this visitor's book and put in the name, date and text? And then he said, yeah, text. He said, you didn't actually have a text. He said, you sort of did a chapter. And I said, yes. Well, I said, you could put in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 to 16. He said, oh, yeah. Brilliant man. Absolutely brilliant. So he wrote in 1 Thessalonians 2, 1 to 16. That was my text. But you see, they're used to just having a text and then a sermon. So they sit and listen. And that was where I found out that it doesn't work with Anglicans. And you say, now, if you look there, if you see what Paul says in verse, and because all the brothers and the Baptists, they all go like that. But they just all sit there. And I say, did you see that? Did you see, look at that? Well, no movement. But in most of the circles from which we come and in which we move, I think you'll find that people do respond. That they will, yeah, if you look at verse 3, they'll follow it through. Now this morning, because we were belting through those areas, although we only really looked up three different books, and that's enough to do. You don't want people turning up chapters and verses every 5 minutes. But yet, within every couple of minutes we were looking back at the text. Because I was saying, now Paul did this, and when he said to that, if you look at this big about Apollos in verse 13, and everybody just does it. And so people are involved, they're active. There's hardly 2 or 3 minutes in the whole 40-minute sermon that they're not actually doing something, responding to what you're saying, turning a page or looking up another verse. And that really solves that concentration span problem. So, look, just get into the Word. Let the Word do its own thing. Trust in the Word. Expound the Word. Open it up. Loose it and let it go. And people get hooked on it. But this idea of what I'm doing now, which is not what I would normally do, but this is a different sort of thing. I'm not preaching sermons. I'm just passing on a few ideas that I hope might be helpful to somebody. You know, one person conducting a monologue for 40 minutes is not conducive to good concentration. No wonder people drop off to sleep. I mean, that's expected. So I think that answers the question concerning the concentration. Somebody also asked a question about personal illustrations. Yeah. Well, I think, again, I mentioned that, but they were in a very unobtrusive way, because I said, like, isn't it true that sometimes, you know, I get out of bed in the morning and we feel a bit grumpy, and so we think, blow it, I'm not going to do this morning. That's a personal illustration. We don't have to big note the thing and say, no, I'm going to tell you about my own personal experience. It just comes in naturally. The same with these applications that I'm talking about. The applications are worked in as we go along, and they just drop very lightly at times. Very lightly, just one sentence or two sentences. If we've expounded it correctly, we just drop the application. So my sermons would tend to have not one application at the end, but all the way through, as you're reading through, well, I've got Jeremiah this time, you're reading through Jeremiah, and you say, and there Jeremiah says this and this and this, and God wants us to be like that. I mean, Jeremiah, you know, runs out of spit as he's sort of talking himself hoarse to the people of Jerusalem, but we need the same sort of thing. I mean, look, God's saying, just human nature is remarkably consistent across the cultures and eras and languages of the world, and, you know, we have the same problem. Well, why don't we do something about it? And people sitting there, yeah, move on to the next verse. You've made your point. It's only taken 15 or 20 seconds, but you've anchored the word home. And that's the sort of thing I'm saying. Just let the Bible do its own thing, expound it, open it up, and just drop the application, ask the question, so that people can see that this is relevant. It might have been Jeremiah thumping around the streets of Jerusalem, but we can see how what he's saying has got something in it for us today. Which brings me to the illustrations thing. Yeah, illustrations are good. Boy, look, I've really messed up these notes terribly, and I've sort of gone off at tangents and all over the shop, so really, I haven't followed my material here very well at all. Sorry about that, but we'll just have to keep going. It's totally messy now, so it'll just be as it comes off the top of their head. But use of illustrations. Now, illustrations do help to relieve the pressure. They do bring people back when their minds have been going off somewhere. They do help to tie things to the everyday so that they can see how this abstract truth or this theological concept can be anchored into the real life. Sure, use the illustrations. But I would like to think that most of the illustrations we use are of the sort that I've been demonstrating. And just when you say, well, you know, we do that, something very, we get out of bed and blow me down before you know where you are. People identify that's an illustration, and that can lock it in. But I would like the illustrations to be fairly ordinary like that. And most of the illustrations by way of analogy rather than by way of story. One of the problems with good stories is that they are so good that they're not typical. And if we tell a really good story that has them on the edge of their seats, it often doesn't really do much other than entertain people because it's so spectacular. It is so exceptional that most people can't identify with it. So, you know, keep these stories fairly ordinary. But I think the analogies are better. Just where you're giving an illustration. Here we go again. Where you want to illustrate... What was it I was talking a bit in that book the other... Oh, faith, okay. Illustration of faith. Now, instead of telling a story about a man who owned a dog and fell down a well and did something, instead of going on and on and on with a nice story, just an illustration of faith. Faith is trust. And so here I am, I'm coming down from Brisbane to Sydney, and I buy a ticket. And they give me the ticket and they take my money. And I've got enough faith to believe that when I get there they'll have an aeroplane waiting to take me to Sydney. Now, all I've got is a bit of paper to show for it, but I trust them. You see, so you trust people. But faith is a bit more than just trust. I mean, I've put my money where my mouth is, and I've got a bit of paper, and I get to the airport, and sure, they have come good. They have been true to their word. My trust has been justified, and they've got a plane there. And I believe it'll fly me to Sydney. But that's trust, but it's still not faith in the true biblical sense yet. Because faith is commitment as well, it's reliance, it's dependence. And I've got to rely upon the thing, so I've actually got to get up and get in the plane, it's got to carry me off. So that faith is not just believing that it's going to do it, it's actually committing ourselves to it. Sure, I believe the thing will take me to Sydney. But until I get on it, then my faith is just so many words. So Faith is really dependence, a very practical thing. I put my trust and faith and I demonstrate it by getting on the thing. And so you're going to apply this to, you know, saving faith or whatever. Now that's just an analogy where you're just likening this to something else that is fairly simple, uncomplicated, that they can identify with. And those are the sorts of illustrations that I tend to use. C.S. Lewis is brilliant at analogies. And all the way through C.S. Lewis's writings, he gives these sort of analogies to illustrate. And so do the people in the Bible. In fact, the Bible is full of illustrations. And if we expounded the Bible in the way that I'm propounding, then we would need a lot fewer illustrations than we might imagine, because the Bible is full of illustrations. It's pictorial. Narrative stories, narratives are stories. Narratives, even the prophets in their preaching, they're using practical down-to-earth illustrations. In fact, I'd say every verse, every second verse has got something pictorial in it. And what we've got to get used to doing is picturing these things, imagining these things. Even the doctrines of the New Testament are all very earthy. Very few of them are discussed in a sort of abstract, conceptual style. They're all given to us in forms of analogies or their illustrations. Even justification is an illustration that comes out of the courtroom of people standing before a judge and either being condemned or acquitted. Redemption is a picture that comes out of the slave market of being bought out of bondage and being set free. So it goes on. Illustration after illustration, theological concepts, the whole thing is very concrete. And I think we've got to change our approach a lot and get away from some of the abstract reasoning and just use the down-to-earth type of argument and explanation that the Bible uses. And if we do that, we'll find it's pictorial. You go through the books of the Bible and it's full of pictures, in whether it's the Gospels, even the epistles of Paul. Now, okay, we've looked this morning at what? Timothy. It's very concrete. He gets stuck into these people and calls them rude names in the opening chapter of 1 Timothy. So you can identify with that. It's not airy-fairy floating around. It's Paul getting angry and hot under the collar and saying all these people are a bunch of nuisances because of the way they mess up the church. And then he says they tell people not to marry and not to drink and not to jump off rocks and whatever he goes on with. Very earthy stuff. The epistles all the way through. And we've got to learn somehow to picture this in our minds. Now the prophets, they are the earthiest characters of the lot. In fact, they're too earthy for us at times. They have a fascination with private parts and bodily functions and the things that Paul says are our unseemly parts that you sort of dress more lavishly and you know, all the things that are not the topics of normal, you know, conversation over cups of tea. They're very, very down-to-earth sort of characters. Now, when we read them, we don't have to dress them up or make them entertaining. Boy, these fellows are entertaining in their own right. Amos, I mean, he just bristles with it. And so does Nahum and Hosea and Joel and all the rest of them. Joel, a locust plague, he sees locusts crawling down people's backs and shaking them out of their shirts and in their porridge and in the cupboards. And so when I read Joel, let's say, and he talks about a locust plague, can't you see all the locusts crawling all through your hair and in the cupboards, and you get into bed and there's a jolly plague of locusts in there with you? No wonder the people were getting a bit annoyed over the whole thing. All the way through, he talks about wine presses and he talks about harvests going rotten and people coming along and getting sloshed at the altar because they've been drinking too much grog, and priests that can't walk straight when they're supposed to be out there administering the sacrifices, they're all half under the weather because they've been getting sloshed with wine and other things. And these are very, very down to earth. Prophet after prophet, page after page, chapter after chapter. We've got to loosen ourselves up a bit. And we won't need illustrations. I honestly never tell a story that's taken out of a storybook, or once upon a time there's a man that did this and this. I really don't need those, because the Bible itself is fun enough, and it's full of those sorts of stories. And even the epistles and the prophets and the so-called theological sections, verse after verse, very, very concrete. So again, we've got to relax a lot more and see the funny side of some of these things too. I'm sure that some of them were meant to be funny, but even if they weren't meant to be funny, they are funny, some of the things that they say. I think I've got an illustration in my book there about Malachi, where Malachi is getting stuck into these people because of the sacrifices they bring. And he said, well, try taking that to the Persian governor. I mean, would he be pleased with you? Incidentally, you can read like that. That's the actual words of the Bible. You don't have to say, "Thou shalt takest this to the Persian governor. Will he be pleased with thee?" Yeah, just loosen up a little bit and put the same sort of expression as Malachi might have put in. He says, "Try offering that to the Persian governor. Would he be pleased with you? Cursed be the cheat who's got a male in his flock," and he vows it, and then he offers to God some inferior thing. And that's just a loosening up, but that's the exact words that are there in the text. So we imagine it, and we see these people bringing along this animal, its legs falling off, and its tail's half gone, and three quarters of the gear's missing, and its patches of hair have been bitten off, and its ribs are sticking out, and bringing along to offer to God. Well, it was going to die anyway, so may as well give it a noble death on the altar and take along and sacrifice it. He says, "Try offering that to the Persian governor. Here you are, Your Excellency. One sheep. It's only got three legs, but you know, better than nothing, but you know, take it while it's going." I mean, you wouldn't do that to the Persian governor. Why do you do it to God? Now, we do the same sort of thing. Goodness me, we do it all the time. We can fill our houses with good things. We always think about the extra buck when it comes to buying a pizza or whatever. And when it comes to having a couple of extra dollars to give to somebody that's in evil strike, you know, I'm a bit strapped for cash this week, actually. You know, a bit of a problem this week. But no sooner have we got a bit of a sweat up in the wind to buy a Coke. We got the cash when we need it. You see, we can look after ourselves, but when it comes to making sacrifices for God or for somebody else, all of a sudden our value system changes, doesn't it? I mean, human nature. And so we can identify with that, and you get the picture across. Malachi gives it, very, very descriptive, very pictorial. Earthy character, Malachi. He's a fellow that says, "I'm going to rub dung in your faces." What a delicate soul. Put him in West Pennant Hill's pulpit tomorrow morning. They're very delicate, these Old Testament prophets. Don't have them home for tea. Alright, that's enough. Now if we can loosen up with the Bible and picture these sorts of things, see what's happening, I think we'll find we need far fewer illustrations than we might imagine. And incidentally, when we give an illustration, let's make sure that we know what we're talking about. Golden rule. Never give an illustration about something that you don't know much about. Now here's Cedric over here. He's a medico. I'll tell you what, I wouldn't give an illustration speaking to this audience that had anything to do with anatomical things or medical things. Apart from the fact that I'm not terribly clever in that area. Let's stick to things I know about. Because if I give an illustration and there's something very wonky about that, I've lost my credibility with people. I mean, supposing we're among a bunch of farmers and we start sounding off about something to do with farming, and all these farmers are sitting there watching the city slicker, and what we say is not really right. They say, what do you expect? But the thing is that our credibility goes down because they think this bloke doesn't know what he's talking about. It actually happened once. I was at a discussion once, and it was an in-house sort of thing. It wasn't a public thing, so we all knew each other, about 25 of us there. And one chap gave an illustration. It was a story that he told about a miraculous healing, and he mentioned something about blood and properties of blood and how it healed miraculously in the case of this person they'd been praying for. But what he didn't realise was that there was a pathologist there. And this pathologist chap said, "Well, Bill," we'll call him, he says, "Bill, maybe God did answer your prayer, and we can appreciate that it was a genuine case of healing, but all that you've just said is utter rubbish," which is one way of putting it, I suppose. He just said, "That's utter rubbish that you've just said about blood, this and this and this and this and this." So the fellow just sort of sat there, and anyway, then the pathologist character explained a little bit, and so he sort of smoothed it over. But you see what I mean? Be very careful the illustrations that we choose. That's another reason why I use few illustrations. Okay, personal illustrations, personal examples are very good. There's no doubt about it that you've got something where you say, "Look, I had an experience like this last week, and I was actually talking to this character, and such and such." Now, that really does ring true sometimes. But we don't want to clutter up the whole sermon with my experiences. But the ring of truth does very often help to earth things, provided we don't use the illustration as a means of blowing our own trumpet. All right, let me see if I can cast my eye over these notes and pick up one or two other bits and pieces. Writing notes. Oh yes, I sometimes write down the opening or maybe closing sentences. Now this would depend if I'm giving a talk at a conference where there's a set topic I've been asked to speak on, I would probably be a lot better behaved than I am today. Obviously you depend on the degree of informality that you might demonstrate. And also, you're much more disciplined in the way you speak and the speed you speak and how you articulate your words is pretty rough and ready today. I'm sorry about that, because I'm racing to get through as much as I can. But if it was a different sort of exercise in a different sort of conference, I probably would write out or memorise my opening phrase or sentence and probably my closing one. A nice clean start without waffling around and a nice clean finish. Problem finishing sometimes if we don't know how to get off the merry-go-round. We go round and round and round and think, how am I going to get out of this? And that's a real problem. So I would suggest that that's a little bit of a ploy. If you can't memorise it, well, just write it down there where you can read it. And sometimes there's a very dicey issue in the middle of your sermon somewhere that you want to say a thing and you want to say it exactly one way only. They don't know that you're up to this, but you do. You know you don't want to be misunderstood, and it's a pretty delicate area. So again, I write it out and I memorise it to make sure all the words are precisely in place. Some very delicate issues you must speak on sometimes, and so we want to be precise. Just a little wrinkle. All right, what else? I've got a note here about we don't have to jazz up our sermon. Some people feel they've got to dress up the Bible because it's a bit boring as it is, and so they've got to make it interesting. Well, frankly, I don't think that's the case. I don't think the Bible's boring at all. And if it is boring, it's probably because the preacher's made it boring. So we've got to work at ways of not only loosening up ourselves, but conveying that in such a way that we don't need to start performing tricks and doing juggling acts on the stage and pulling rabbits out of hats and doing all sorts of other things to keep people awake and alive and to switch them on. The word itself will switch people on if we handle it in the correct way. Another thing is to probably sometimes update your illustrations by thinking of a modern equivalent. I've just done that a little bit with the illustration of the sacrificial animal. We don't have sacrificial animals today, but yeah, I suppose you can get some sort of modern parallel. But just looking at things that happen in the Bible and some of the things God says, I think in my book I've mentioned how Amos, I'm not sure if it's Amos or Isaiah now, but anyway, one of the prophets says, I'm going to press you down as a cart presses that is full of sheaves. That was the heaviest thing they knew, a cart full of sheaves. And God says, I'm going to steamroll you into the ground. Well, steamrollers have gone now. I'm going to run over you like a 10-ton truck. You know, that's the sort of thing. So we read the Bible and then just make that modern parallel or equivalent. It only takes 10 seconds to say, but it has woken them up, it's alive, and it helps people to see that this ancient word is still relevant. The word was written in a context, in a cultural context, and we understand it in that context, but then if we can just give some little aside at times to identify it with things that we might understand, well, so much the better. Got to be very careful of sweeping statements, particularly in relation to prosperity or suffering. You know the sort of thing I'm talking about. Prayer, very dangerous. People giving open checks concerning prayer. Very, very dangerous to make sweeping statements when somebody in the audience can think of an exception. So we maybe have to qualify or modify our speech by saying in most cases, and as is general, or in general, you'd probably pick me up quite a few times that I've said, you know, generally speaking, or by and large, that sort of covers a multitude of sins, that type of expression. But don't lock yourself into a situation where you're making an absolute statement, God will answer your prayers. That sounds good, doesn't it? And then somebody can think of a case where it simply does not happen. God is not obliged to answer our prayers, and we all know that sometimes he doesn't. So when it comes to prayer or suffering, the Lord can heal you, the Lord can do this, and the Lord can do something else. We will ruin our credibility, and the whole sermon can fall flat just on one exaggeration or sweeping statement where people can think of exceptions. So those applications and challenges and triumphant statements, we have to think of them very carefully so that we don't go over the top and then people aren't inclined to listen to us any further. Something else came into my mind then, and it dropped out of my mind. I've tried here to say not to be predictable in our applications and also to have a bit of variety in our applications. Now, some people are very predictable. I've got two friends, I've got more than two friends actually, but two friends whose names come to mind. Both have the habit of being very predictable in their applications. One of them, no matter what he's speaking on, whether it's the book of Numbers or Second Chronicles or the prophet Hosea or Mark's Gospel or the Epistle of James, it doesn't matter, he will always finish up with his application in Romans 6. He's big on victorious living. So, you know, Romans 6, 7 and 8, that area, the sort of triumphant Christian life stuff, he'll always finish. He's quite good. I mean, he's quite good in expounding Romans 6, 7 and 8. But what I'm saying is, that wasn't meant as a joke, what I'm saying is that he's only got one string in his fiddle. And so no matter what you ask him to speak on, bet your boots, that's the way it'll finish up. I've got another friend who also is a very well-known speaker, excellent expositor and Bible scholar and all the rest of it. He always finishes up in Romans 3, 4 and 5. He's a justification by faith man. So again, it doesn't matter where you are, the Song of Songs, you'll still finish up in you know where you finish up in the Song of Songs. You finish up in Romans 3, 4 or 5. So we've got to be careful of those pet, I call them pet applications. I notice just some people in our church have got onto disobedience. And so I said, well, what do you find out then? And they said, we've got to always be obedient. I said, that sounds terrific. What's it mean? What do you mean by being obedient? Let's be more specific about this. And then you find that they're hiding behind an expression. Let's be specific. Think of a few things and what the Bible says. How are you going to be obedient? Just be obedient to the Bible. That sounds great. Let's all be obedient to the Bible. Let's come to a few specific things. What does the Bible say here now? Are we obedient? And all of a sudden, this broad generalization is focused in a particular thing where we're not very obedient at all. So those broad words like be obedient, bless, may the Lord bless you. What's that mean? Well, it can be used in a biblical sense, but it couldn't be used in a very lazy sense, where it's a nice broad term that covers anything and means nothing. It just is a nice way of finishing off the prayer sometimes. So we've got to think all the time of the words we're using and the applications and how they might be relevant and consistent. Yes, not being predictable, not having our pat. What's his name's? All right, I suppose I could conclude here by just reminding ourselves that people are remarkably perceptive and very ready to jump on us if our lives are not consistent with what we're talking about. We all know the bland criticism of the church, the stereotype that all Christians are hypocrites. And unfortunately it's true in some cases, and people, even within our own fellowship, will be very ready to see if we are making ourselves out to be something when we're speaking and yet in our own lives are contradicting one of the statements we've just made. There is a particular warning given to Christian teachers that we're all aware of. What is it? James chapter 3 verse 1, I think. Or was it chapter 4? Chapter 3, yeah. Don't be over keen to be a big time teacher, because those who teach are subject to a more stringent judgment. And that's a fairly frightening thing. But that doesn't mean to say we're to chicken out entirely and not do it. We ought to do it. But we ought to make sure that we are not saying something and making out we are something when in reality it's something different. It's good to have a wife or a husband or a son or daughter or, you know, some close person. Who was that? Yeah. Son? Yeah. Yeah, somebody. Oh, fair enough. We came from a... Our family was a family where people were encouraged to be serious Bible students and serious in their approach to the Word and all the rest of it. We didn't want people to be harpingly critical of everybody that got up in the pulpit. But they weren't all that shy in telling Dad, you know, some of the things he needed to know. And I think if we've got somebody like that, that's great. And it's nice to have somebody that points out. My wife every now and again will point out a few mannerisms that need to be corrected. See yourself on video, if you're game. Listen to tapes. I take a tape recorder with me every now and again and tape myself as I'm speaking just to take it home and listen to it and find all the bad habits I've picked up since I cleaned up the last lot. We just cleaned up a whole lot and we think we're back on track again, and then just when you've got this one under control, something else bobs up. So any sort of discipline like that where you can hear yourself, see yourself, you know, it's excellent to carry on those sorts of critiques. Very careful about aping other people, but at the same time we can learn from other people. I don't want to ape Eric Reed. Who could ape Eric Reed anyway? Someone said to me once after I'd been down Melbourne, they said, we had Eric Reed one week and we had you the next week. They said, you want to go and watch your Eric? Everything was mobile and, you know, all the colour and the voice and the style. And they said, you just got up there and went boom, 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 boom. Well, not everybody can perform like Eric, can they? But so don't ape a person. But on the other hand, I can watch Eric or I can watch Cedric or someone else, and you pick up a few little wrinkles along the way, learn things that are very valuable. Tom Carson learned a lot of things. We must be very wary. Not to be dogmatic where able scholars differ. And so we can pick up... Someone down here is getting out of control. Those attitudes are important. I'm very thankful to Tom for some of the attitudes that he instilled in us on that score of not being overconfident in your own opinions when people cleverer than you have various other opinions. So, yeah, we can learn from people, attitudes, ways of doing things. And it's interesting how people up Brisbane, in my own church, have sometimes come and said, hey, I picked this, I noticed that you're doing this. I said, boy, you're a very perceptive character. I didn't think anybody had woken up to that little wrinkle I had. And he says, oh yeah, I worked it out. Little wrinkles you have to get yourself out of a tight spot or to get you around something. And people pick it up. That's good. If you keep your eye open, we can learn a lot from observing. We can also learn what not to do. You've probably learned a few things today on some of the things you shouldn't do. Speech too fast, slurred, you know, rushing over. Okay. Those are all things, don't let this happen to you. But I think we better stop here. Oh yes, here's another one, concentration span. You read these stories and these comments that people today have a concentration span of whatever number of minutes because of TV commercials and kids at school and all the rest of it. And so therefore your sermon ought not to be longer than 10 minutes. Or 15 or 20 or 25 or whatever the magic figure is. There is some truth in that, but that's not the full truth. And I think most of us have found out that if the content that a person has is good, then the time doesn't really mean all that much. If the content's no good, then 5 minutes is far too long. So we're coming back all the time to content. It is content that is going to determine the worth of what we say. Techniques, clarity of speech, style, presentation, personality, there's a whole range of other things that interact that are going to make our presentation mediocre or better or worse. But above all, content. And if the content is no good, then there's nothing can save it as far as I can see. Jokes or, you know, three-ring circles or anything. There's nothing that can save it if the content is no good. And 10 minutes is too long for a bad sermon, but half an hour is not enough for a good one. And I have found that people will hang on in there. If you go through the Bible, go through a book, go through a chapter, they'll hang on in there without too much difficulty if they're being fed the Word. And true Christians will really respond to the Word like babes to their mother's milk. It is natural. And when they get it, say, hey, this is the real thing, why didn't I hear this before? People respond to the Word And so what we've got to do is deal with it in such a way that it's opening it up and they're making that response. Not that they're coming to us afterwards and saying, you know, giving us all accolades and pats on the back, but as I said, coming to us afterwards and saying that they've learned something. And we can all learn something. I was telling the students the other day about a lady in England. I had been doing the stuff in some place there, and I just happened to mention how that these were actual people that were being spoken to in Paul's letters. They were real letters that were written to real people. Now, I was brought up where in a tradition where it never occurred to me that these were letters written to people. They were books in the Bible. They were verses in the Bible, and they all contained holy truth that we had to memorize and put into practice or something. Ephesians was the name of a book in the Bible. It never occurred to me that it was the name of people who lived in a town called Ephesus. Ephesians is the name of a book. And I happen to say, I said, some people, Ephesians, now Ephesians is just the name of a black and white cow. That's the best they know about Ephesians, black and white cow. Colossians is a sort of rubber shoe you put on when it's raining. And that's about the extent of it. But Colossians were actually people like Sydneysiders or Brisbaneites or whatever, and they live in a town and they do things. And these are characters that lived in a place called Colossae. And they had a few problems, and Paul says, hey, here we go, cop this lot, and he gives them some teaching he thinks they need to know. So we went on. I didn't sort of use that language, not in Britain anyway. So you use that language and use that illustration to try to get across the idea that these are letters written to real people. Anyway, as again, I'm greeting all the people as they pass through the door. One lady who'd probably been in the church for 50 years, she said, well, thank you for that tonight. That was so interesting. I was one of those people that thought Ephesians were black and white cows. And then you feel like sneaking through the floor. Because this dear old soul. But isn't it tragic? Been in a church all her life and had never seen until that night that this was not just the name of a book, but these were, real people. We run Bible studies among non-Christian people, and then hopefully they become Christians. And one night we'd gone through Romans, we'd gone through Acts, and we're going through Corinthians. And we do a few chapters a night, and I got her to get them to read up. Her husband wanted to read up a bit extra before I come back the next week. When I come back the next week, the wife said to me, she said, I was a bit worried about that, what I read. We're up to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And she said, it bothered me a bit. It said, it's good for a man not to marry. And I thought, that's funny. The Bible teaches that a man shouldn't marry. But then she said, I thought for a while, and I thought to myself, no, that's not the way to look at it. It's not that the Bible says it's better not to marry. Paul was saying to the Corinthians it was better for a man not to marry. And then he goes on and talks about why he said that. Mary and I said, that's marvellous. I said, I know people who've been in churches for 30 years and they haven't got that far yet. And they're still saying, you know, the Bible says this. But she was right. And that's the way we would approach the Bible. Not, yeah, the Bible says this, the Bible says that. But we're seeing that Paul said to the Corinthians that, and then there were reasons why he said it, and he explains the reasons, and we learn from it. So we don't just pluck the thing out and go throwing at someone in the audience that we don't like. But rather, we say, what's he saying? Why is he saying it? What can I learn from it? Well, I don't know what you'll learn from that particular verse, but I hope you've learned something from some of the other verses.